Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are once again tuned into my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. Well, it is quite a scene with this problem in Japan, and we'll get to this potential pending issue of radioactive pollution that may come to the United States. I'll be talking about that, but before I do that, I want to cover the other health news of the past week. We have a study here, coffee lowers stroke risk. And basically, drinking two or more cups of coffee per day was associated with a 22% to 25% lower risk of stroke in women. This is a large study following about 35,000 Swedish women for more than 10 years. So, coffee, while it is a stimulant and can certainly be overdone, also has a lot of advantages, some of which may be improving glucose metabolism. Some may be based on the fact that coffee, especially quality coffee, may be quite a good antioxidant, which is kind of an interesting angle on the issue. And I think also it helps move along the digestive tract for a lot of people, helping them to clear waste products more efficiently. So there's a number of angles to coffee. I mean, coffee beans themselves, especially if you fresh grind your own beans, you're going to get active antifungals in the coffee beans. So, you know, they're a germ control thing. So, you know, there's a number of angles where they may be contributing to health problems that are affecting a lot of people. And so it's an interesting article, but it's certainly not harmful to you as long as you're not overdoing it and as long as you are still sleeping and not more stressed out than normal from drinking it or more hyper or something. Just the amount of it helps a lot of systems in the body for, at least in this case, women, to significantly reduce the risk of stroke. Resveratrol helps break down stored fat. Well, resveratrol, of course, has its claim to fame by activating the gene system called SIRT1, or SIRT1, and that gene system is associated with longevity. So when we do calorie restriction and cutting back on calories activates the SIRT1 gene, resveratrol activates SIRT1, even though you're not necessarily cutting back or restricting calories as much. So it's kind of a way of activating the processes of the benefits of calorie restriction without necessarily restricting calories as much. Now, in a new study here, it is found that the one of the other aspects of resveratrol is its action specifically on white adipose tissue cells, your stored fat cells, and it helps them to break down the fat in them and release them. Now, that's a good thing, and of course, that would possibly contribute to weight loss. We do have to understand that the white adipose tissue we have is always breaking down fat and always restoring fat. So obviously, if you're eating more than you need, you're going to be storing more fat rather than breaking down more fat, regardless of how many different things you're taking to break down stored fat, because it's kind of a natural process. And you overwhelm it with too much food coming in, your body has no choice but to store more than to release more. However, if you're all of a sudden now watching your diet and eating well, and hopefully following the five rules of the leptin diet, then a nutrient like resveratrol can help upregulate your metabolism and help break down fat, which would then contribute to weight loss because now there isn't as much calorie coming in. So the nutrients aren't going to make you lose weight if you're eating too much food. It's just not technically possible. That's not how nutrition works. But the guide here and the goal would be to have tools to help your body along, especially if it has gotten into kind of a sluggish state. And resveratrol would be one possible helpful nutrient that could be part of your weight management team. Apple polyphenols, which is primarily quercetin, for extended lifespan. So this study was done in fruit flies, which is kind of a model for testing things on extension of lifespan. They found that apple polyphenols could increase the lifespan by 10%. This was not done by activating the SIRT1 gene. It was done by activating antioxidant enzymes. So we take a lot of antioxidant nutrients, and they all have specific functionality in terms of contributing to deactivating the myriad types of free radicals that could be going on in our body. That's why you want all kinds of different antioxidants, because there's all kinds of different free radicals, and you need, you know, a kind of a comprehensive approach to deal with it. It's not just one kind of free radical and one kind of antioxidant. You've got very complex chemistry. But besides nutrients that have antioxidant activity in and of themselves, some nutrients help actually turn on your body's own antioxidant enzyme systems. And this would include systems like the superoxide dismutase enzyme system, the catalase enzyme system. These are like major working powerhouse systems in your body that run antioxidant functionality in bulk. And so the quercetin was found to activate those antioxidant systems and support their functionality, which of course then improves the general antioxidant network and your antioxidant defense systems collectively, which is a whole bunch of things that have to work together properly. So I guess that's why an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And we'll change that expression now to an apple a day can keep Western medicine away, because Western medicine is probably the most dangerous thing you can do for your health. Not in the short term and not for acute problems, but if you're expecting doctors to help you with preventive health, long-term health needs, even how to manage a problematic health situation over time, you are asking for the type of help that is not necessarily going to be help. Now, that's not always true, but it's true in a lot of situations, especially with the medications being utilized these days. It's hard to understand how so many intelligent doctors can actually do this to so many people and think that it's normal or even helpful. I mean, I don't know whether we're talking about blood pressure medication, cholesterol medication, blood sugar medication. Yes, people have health problems, but these drugs don't fix them. And they often make other things worse. And so, that's why an apple a day might help keep you, the doctors and Western medicine, away. Our friendly FDA unleashes a biological experiment on lupus patients. They have the first drug for lupus in 50 years that they have approved. Yes, it costs $35,000 per year, and it's supposed to become a blockbuster drug. It does seem as a powerful immune system suppressor to modestly relieve symptoms and cause fewer flare-ups. That's, I guess, what $35,000 of drug can do for somebody, except the fact that on a lot of people it doesn't work at all. They have much more severe infections, and in the studies submitted to the FDA, higher numbers of people died faster and had much, you know, worse infections. So here we have something with modest benefit, huge downside, which will be sold anyway and is expected to cost the tax-paying health system initially about $1 billion, but it's going to pass that, because this will get used for all kinds of off-label things it was never intended for, because the big pharma considers it now an approved asset that they must maximize the sales of, typically illegally and off-label use. And so this, again, is the FDA not really looking out for people, although, you know, FDA gets criticized for not releasing experiments. You know, my solution to this is, you know, if you want to put it on the market, fine, but no insurance company should pay for this. And I would only make people pay for it if they're actually improved by it and they want to pay for it themselves. This is ridiculous, the cost to the healthcare system for this sort of moderate improvement in health. It is not hard to fix people. I mean, these are lupus is a autoimmune health problem. It is not impossible to fix. It is not impossible to solve. But, you know, just taking sledgehammers to the immune system doesn't fix it, and it costs a fortune. So, you know, I mean, obviously there are people out there suffering, and that's why this kind of thing gets approved, but it is just not the sales of it should be highly restricted, should not be allowed to go beyond certain points and should not rack up humongous costs to the healthcare system, which is certainly what's going to happen with this. I mean, just look at the atypical antipsychotics, and you see how psychotic this industry has become. And it is going to not be able to hide behind the fact that it's trying to help people solve their health problems, because it is bankrupting the healthcare system and preventing people who need healthcare that is actually definable and might actually help them for emergency medical needs and various needs and treatment needs. It's raising the cost of that kind of healthcare, which is actually something legitimate, out the roof. Whey protein is a superior metabolic activator. Well, obviously, those of you who listen to me on a regular basis know that I'm a big fan of whey protein. I think it is probably one of the most superior foods ever produced, especially when the whey protein is made properly. Not all whey proteins are the same. Some have broken protein molecules that are just, you know, made with older technology and they're just not up to snuff. But a quality whey protein is a superior food source, and it has a higher level of thermogenic or heat-producing, calorie-burning activity, which is now proven in a new study. So that is a good thing. And whenever you increase thermogenic activity by eating whey protein, you actually help to throw calories away as heat. So that's, you know, very nice. It's just one more aspect, more proof that whey protein is a great tool. I like it at breakfast, even more often if you're trying to lose weight. But breakfast for sure, just to get your adrenals and your body started on the right foot for the day. I think it makes a big difference. It doesn't mean you have to have every breakfast of this, but certainly most breakfasts, especially when you're in a hurry, it's a very good way to go. No pun intended. Low levels of potassium linked to increased diabetes risks. Now, I think this is a very important study because it shows that potassium, even in the normal range, can predispose for risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So, but basically what this study is saying is that the current lab ranges for potassium, which is 3.5 to 5.5, is really not appropriate for the prevention of blood sugar problems. And you actually need to optimize potassium into the higher end of the normal range between 5 and 5.5 to not have normal risk, or to not have an elevated risk. They found, you know, for example, if you look at the very middle of the lab range number, it's like, well, 4.5. And so scores of 4 to 4.5 had a 64% increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes, and even scores between 4.5 and 5, which is sort of in the higher side of the normal, had a 39% increased risk. That's just unbelievable. I mean, this is major information of high relevance. So the lack, now most of the potassium is not, you know, the potassium in your blood is not that much. So most of the potassium is supposed to be inside the cells of your body. That's where it's supposed to be. So when you're seeing functionally or just even a little bit off scores in the blood, it's predicting that there is a much larger deficiency inside the cells. And that's why these even small drops, even within the normal range, are problematic to the development of type 2 diabetes. And so this is confirmed in about three different studies, which I go over here. But it is clearly significant. And so potassium, of course, bananas, avocados, fresh fruit and vegetables in general, potassium supplements can be very, very helpful and would be a good idea, especially if you are heat intolerant or you sweat a lot with your exercise. You need to replace potassium. And you know, this is a common lab test. So when you get your blood done, you'll see your potassium score. You want it between 5 and 5.5 for optimal blood sugar functionality. This is a simple test. It's easy to understand. It's commonly done. Just look at your numbers. Where are you? And if you're not high enough, I would suggest more potassium intake via fruit or supplements or vegetables, you know, but get it up because For some reason or another, a lack of potassium is very telling about cellular malfunction because it, you know, potassium has to be highly concentrated in cells. And if you're lacking it and it's not there, things don't go right in that cell and they may not be as efficient metabolically. And that is, the issue in part. And then, of course, potassium appears needed to help release insulin from the pancreas. So a deficiency of potassium for the pancreas itself is problematic to it making enough insulin, so maybe that's part of it. But you've got a cellular issue all over your body. You've got an organ issue with the pancreas. But you've got an issue, and it's a simple thing to fix. And if that's all it takes to fix the risk for becoming diabetic, I mean, that's like simple. And maybe have profound effects. Of course, this is going to help your blood pressure as well, because the intolerance to salt is actually rooted in a potassium deficiency. So, for example, if you're a person who eats salt and gets swollen from it, you notice your rings are tighter, etc., after you have salt, you're lacking potassium by definition. We know that now. So, salt gets a bad name because you are potassium lacking. So, keep that in mind. It's important, especially as the summer comes and it's hotter out, your quote-unquote electrolytes are tested more, of which potassium is key, or one key electrolyte. So if you're already lacking, one of the signs that you're going to struggle is intolerance to heat and sensitivity to hotter days. And that's a sign for sure that you're more in need of potassium just to get through the challenge of the heat, but it also then would reflect that your baseline potassium function is probably not adequate, which you can now tell this data is really saying, look at your lab tests. This is simple. This is easy. Get it between 5 and 5.5. Okay, top story of the week is obviously the radiation nuclear power plant issues in Japan, which as each day goes by seems to be getting worse. And of course there are various experts coming on. I'm not a nuclear expert. I don't claim to be one. So I personally do not know what all of this means in terms of one of these reactors blowing out and creating a huge radioactive particle cloud that could get into the jet stream and come over to the United States. Some people are saying, no, this isn't going to ever happen. And other people are saying, well, this is a major issue. And so it just kind of depends seemingly on which expert happens to be experting in terms of what they happen to be saying. So obviously, when you have that kind of conflict of opinion going on, it is prudent to at least understand what you might do if there were a radioactive cloud heading your way. So I want to go over that with you here because we could be facing that kind of a problem in the United States. If there is such a large cloud released and it gets into the jet stream, it could hit, depending on how the winds are blowing on any given day, really anywhere from a Los Angeles all the way on up to Alaska. So there's quite a wide swath of the U.S. that could be affected. Of course, once it hits, it's going to get into the typical jet stream pattern that, you know, kind of comes down over the Midwest and, you know, loops down south depending on what's going on. So, but these jet streams could carry some degree of radioactive particles. And again, you know, I don't know the extent, I can't speak with certainty to what degree this would be a problem, even if the reactors blow apart in Japan. I mean, who knows? Maybe the wind will blow towards Korea, China, and Russia for a couple of days. I mean, anything is possible here. So we're just, all I'm saying is understand the subject a little better and do as much preparation as you feel is relevant to you. Without going overboard on the subject and panicking and thinking, you know, this is whatever. So obviously the issue of iodine is important. The iodine, higher doses of iodine should not be taken just because something might happen. They should only be taken at a time when you know radiation is coming. It is probably a good idea to preload your body with iodine about 24 hours prior to exposure. and keep it maximized in your body during any kind of exposure risk. That would be the prudent thing to do. When you're using iodine and you have a large amount of it in your system, it will accumulate in your thyroid gland and it will protect it from taking up radioactive iodine, which would be the main concern. So that is very, very important. And that's why, of course, the Japanese officials are handing out potassium iodide. Now, as you most of you know, potassium iodide is more likely to clog the thyroid gland than the water-soluble iodine I like to use. So the taking high low doses of iodine is not without risk, but it's a risk worth taking if there is an acute exposure to radiation, because you could have long-term damage that it's going to be very difficult to recover from in the thyroid. So iodine saturation, you could take, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 drops of liquid, rub it over your thyroid gland. Nobody knows the exact dose required to help. But, you know, when you're taking, you know, 5 to 10 milligrams of iodine at a time, you could apply it two or three times a day, or you could drink it if you wanted to. I think topical application right over the thyroid gland would be very, very protective, and it's what I would do in this situation if it's coming to where I am. Of course, I'm likely to smear iodine all over my body if I knew I was in acute exposures. So, I mean, iodine is protecting more. I mean, there's more places in your body that iodine-related compounds react than just your thyroid gland. So the focus is on protecting the thyroid gland, but you got to understand a lot of receptors all over your body for hormones, you know, utilize iodine. So iodine has many functions in your body, and having a lot of it to protect and saturating it as a precaution if you're exposed is really good common sense. Anyway, that would only be done if there is a known exposure going on, not just done for the heck of building up a preventive reserve of iodine or something. And the reason for that is because the results to the thyroid can be somewhat unpredictable. So that's that. Okay, now, the story shouldn't stop there, although that's about where it seems to stop as far as public health officials are concerned. But let me say what you should be doing now is building up your antioxidant status. And that is because radiation generates really dramatic amounts of free radicals. If the free radicals form a free radical party, a cascade of interacting free radicals, which can happen if your antioxidant defenses are low, then you can make the most toxic of all free radicals, peroxynitrite. And that then is highly damaging to DNA anywhere in your body, not just in your thyroid gland. So it can damage brain, it can damage liver, it can damage kidneys, it can damage heart, it can damage sex hormone sites, your ovaries, your testicles. All of these areas are subject to radiation damage of magnitude. Of course, you know, a woman wouldn't want to be exposed to this because her eggs would be damaged. And, of course, that would be another, now that I'm thinking about it, reason for iodine, because you could rub iodine all over your tummy, and it would be taken up by the ovaries. The fastest way to uptake iodine into the ovaries, by the way, is to apply it vaginally, which has very, very high uptake into the ovaries, which would give protection to your eggs, which would be very important for future children. So, you know, these kind of things... you know, back to the iodine. But in general, you need antioxidants, and there are many antioxidants. They work in a synergistic network. So while vitamin C is one antioxidant, as an example, just taking vitamin C would be not the most important thing. You'd want a whole array of antioxidants, including vitamin C. One study with a cocktail of antioxidants, in this case, it was selenium, vitamin C, N-acetylcysteine, lipoic acid, vitamin E, and CoQ10, started 24 hours after a lethal level of radiation exposure. So this is animals where they give them a lethal dose of radiation. The animals that got all those antioxidants all lived. No problem. whereas within 4 days, the rest of the animals were dead. So we know antioxidants defend against radiation, and an antioxidant network is really important. Next thing to understand about this is, what is your antioxidant status? If you are overweight, it's generally not good unless you're in a weight loss mode. If you are stressed out, it's generally not good because you're using them all up to combat stress. If you are a junk food eater in poor health, as a lot of Americans are, you already have such shoddy antioxidant status that you are much more susceptible to radiation damage. So depending on your general health, your general fitness, your health issues, the more of them you have, the more you need to bolster antioxidants when there is a time of extra need, such as possible radiation exposure. You should ideally do that ahead of time so that your body's more ready rather than wait. Now, in the article I've written here, I highlight three antioxidants in particular. One of them is gamma-tocotrienol, a special form of vitamin E that we use. Gamma-tocotrienol, recently there was an experiment conducted by the U.S. Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute, and here they again exposed animals to whole body radiation, and then they watched the DNA damage, and they watched the damage to the stem cells in the bone marrow. So your bone marrow is constantly rejuvenating your red blood cells, your white blood cells, and of course if you get DNA damage in your bone marrow, then you're much more likely to have leukemia and all these other forms of blood cancers and things, lymphoma, whatnot. I mean, you're at much higher risk for that. So the study showed that the treatment with gamma-tocotrienol maintained 80 to 86% of the capacity for making correctly stem cells into blood cells, whereas in the non-treated animals, when they were exposed to radiation, that was knocked down by 50%, reflective of a lot of DNA damage. So this is very, very dramatic protection. And the author said, you know, essentially that this treatment was very good at preventing persisting DNA damage. So, you know, that's an animal study, but nevertheless, it's a study showing that gamma-tocotrienol can specifically protect against high-dose radiation exposure. There was another study with gamma-tocotrienol that showed it could deactivate peroxynitrite formation in response to radiation exposure. And once again, that peroxynitrite, that is the King Kong killer of free radicals. And once you get that sucker going, it damages DNA big time. So gamma-tocotrienol was able to short-circuit that. So gamma-tocotrienol is something you want to have in your plan. Lipoic acid is a very small, versatile, fat and water-soluble antioxidant. Animal studies show that it can maintain the antioxidant defense system in multiple body tissues upon radiation exposure. So, again, animal studies, that's what we have here. We don't conduct human studies on radiation exposure. I mean, we do, based on CT scans being done for anything and everything, but that's not really a controlled experiment. That's an uncontrolled experiment, which is not a good one, by the way. But in terms of studying nutrients and radiation exposure, it's mostly animals, because that's, you know, it's for obvious reasons. So someone out there is going, well, where's your human studies on this? Well, you know, find a bunch of humans who want to volunteer to be exposed to radiation as the control group. That would be zero. So let's not, let's not worry that we don't have in-depth human studies here. We have to do the best we can with what we do have. So lipoic acid shown to protect and bolster the antioxidant network. Again, you've got to have antioxidants in general. But if you have also lipoic acid in that mix, it's really good at bolstering the entire antioxidant defense system. Even 10 years after the fact, in the workers from Chernobyl, the cleanup workers, they brought in Latvia workers to clean up their Chernobyl accident, and these 6,000 workers have all kinds of health problems. But a test done with them, a two-month trial with 600 milligrams of lipoic acid, found that it normalized a lot of their lab parameters, but certainly not all of them, and this was 10 years after the fact. We have another animal study recently showing that pre-treatment with lipoic acid significantly reduces the radiation exposure damage in the brain. So, you know, that's good news. So lipoic acid is another antioxidant with science showing it can help offset radiation injury. And then our United States Department of Agriculture, they do some great research there, by the way, has shown that blueberries and strawberries can prevent brain damage from radiation exposure. You might wonder why there's so much interest in this or why there are even these amount of studies. A lot of it is because of outer space exploration where there is a lot of radiation exposure. And so they're trying to figure out how to help astronauts and space exploration. Not only is this being done in the context of potential exposures like we're having now with Japan, but also for other reasons. Anyway, the USDA found that blueberries and strawberries protected the brain. We know that blueberry and strawberry extracts, especially blueberries, are very helpful to cleaning up brain tissue injury, protecting the brain. And interestingly, they found that blueberries and strawberries protected different regions of the brain, which is a good reason to eat both of them and take supplements that contain both of them. All right, the bottom line here is that your own having an adequate antioxidant defense system for good health in general is just common sense. The more your antioxidant bank account is depleted, the more you're going to have health problems. That's just obvious. So antioxidants in general, always helpful and always needed, especially if you're under any kind of stress. So anytime your stress level goes up, whether you exercise more, whether you have more emotional stress, whether you're cutting your sleep short, whether you're overweight, whether you have some health problem, whenever you've got stressful issues impacting on your body, even if they're seemingly positive, you need more antioxidants because you use them up faster. That's fairly simple. So an exerciser who exercises a lot always needs more antioxidants because they're putting more demands on their body. That's stressful to the body, even though it's good. If you're getting a good response to it, you're putting your body through a conditioning of stress that uses up your antioxidants. That, by the way, is why Olympic athletes get sick more than injured, because their antioxidants run low. Anyway, radiation is just simply another type of stress, but it's a nasty kind of stress. So, you know, it just makes sense that if there's a potential stressor that could be going on, you bolster your antioxidants, and if that stressor happens, then you really bolster your antioxidants and your iodine. And that will help you to understand how to offset any acute issues relating to this, if they should even happen. So we'll hope that none of this materializes, but at least we want to be empowered with knowledge should it happen on what to do, because radiation injury can have lifelong, devastating side effect consequences. And I don't want to be a fear monger. Nobody does. And nobody wants to state the nature of the problem inappropriately. But not explaining it and not talking about it for fear of being a fear monger, that's the other side of the coin. That's just as stupid. So, you know, somewhere in the middle there is some level of common sense. I'll leave it to each and every one of you to decide how much of that applies to you and how much you want to take this information to heart. Certainly, I guess you want to keep an eye on the news, and that will tell you. And certainly, if there is a problem, then I guess what I'm saying might be more relevant to you. And anyway, I've done my best to tell you what to do. And so I am now happy that I have been able to communicate that, because, you know, you're certainly not going to see that on the network news. All right, we're going now to your questions for this week. First one up comes from Pasquale, who says, I absolutely love your podcast and listen to it religiously as I drive to work. I truly respect your opinion and value what you have to say. Honestly, it's like a nutritional course in my car every time I listen, and I find this very empowering. And I'll interrupt here and thank you for your kind words, Pasquale. I get this kind of email often. I don't always put all of the nice words in front of the questions, because then it just sort of sounds like I'm always saying something nice about myself. But I really do appreciate all of you writing into me and telling me how much you appreciate the podcast, because, you know, it is kind of a labor of love, and I just enjoy doing it, and I enjoy answering your questions. All right, so the question from Pasquale. We have a 7-year-old who has gotten croup every year since he was about 2, usually wintertime. I've researched the heck out of it in search of a preventive strategy, but everything I found says, in essence, it's viral and some children are susceptible more than others. Our pediatrician says children usually get it till they are about 10 years of age, and then it goes away, so to speak, as the immune system continues to get stronger. Is there anything you recommend for children? We do give them a good multiple vitamin to boost their immunity. What exactly would you prescribe or recommend to help prevent these yearly croup attacks, which are quite frightening as a parent? Well, croup generally is viral, as you're pointing out here. It can sometimes be bacterial. Your pediatrician is correct in that you do, quote-unquote, tend to outgrow it as your immune system gets stronger and learns the lessons. But you've got to understand, of course, that this is happening in the lungs. So you got two main issues to think about in terms of preventive. One, if it's happening in the winter, then the cold air coming in is too much stress for the integrity of the respiratory barrier, and it's more easily breached, meaning that once exposed to cold air, the child's respiratory system is now more at risk. That tends to mean right away that the endothelial lining, the cells that line the protective cells that line the lungs, are lacking, and or that the immune system that would respond to an initial attack is lacking in effort, meaning the secretory IgA immune response isn't adequate. So the most important things there would be to boost up that secretory IgA. Again, we're talking about antioxidants, and that needs to be carotene-based or have some carotenes in them. N-acetylcysteine is another good one. I like our Daily Protector for a child that can be pulled apart and mixed in things. The grapeseed extract, if they don't like. Daily Protector is kind of tart-tasting because of the vitamin C that's in it, but that's probably the single best supplement for respiratory support that's an all-purpose antioxidant for general immune protection for a child. You know, other things, the GI Muscle Helper, which is a powder that can be mixed up into water or mixed in yogurt or something, that helps strengthen the mucosal lining in the lungs. And so these things would be helpful tips to your child. And then realize that the immune system in the lungs and the immune system in the digestive tract uses the same defense system. So normally, when a weak spot is showing up in the lungs, it is indicative of a weak spot in the digestive system. So your child might be eating too much sugar, too much food coloring, too much junk, had too many antibiotics maybe, who knows. But acidophilus is good. GI and Muscle Helper, as I said, is good. GI Soother is good. Immune Plus is really helpful for children in general as an immune booster. You've got a lot of options. So you're thinking strength of the respiratory lining. You're thinking strength of the immune response in the respiratory system, and realizing that that is a subset of the digestive integrity, and working on cleaning up the diet so it's better, sugar being the number one immunosuppressor. All right. Brian says, I teach physical education and health at elementary school, and right now we're having an outbreak of influenza A and B. I would like to recommend some foods to our school that would help combat these illnesses. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking whey protein, blueberries, and coconut oil. What would be your suggestions? What diet recommendations should I give them? Thanks so much. Well, whey protein, blueberries, and coconut oil would all be just fine. Coconut oil may or may not convert to lauric acid and kill viruses. It's possible. Blueberries would be a good immune booster, as would all mixed berries. Whey protein, of course, has got essentially ready-made glutathione, or activates glutathione activity very easily, which is the primary antioxidant required for the immune system to function. And a number of the proteins are in what's called immunoglobulin form anyway, so they rapidly help a child make antibodies. So these foods that you're suggesting here, Brian, are all good choices. Diet itself, besides just eating good quality foods, the most important things are eliminating the junk. So it's eliminating the junk fats, the potato chips, the French fries, the corn chips, getting the kids off of that stuff entirely, and especially off of sugar in between meals. Sugar in between meals is the single most immunosuppressive compound known. So snacking on sugar, eating cookies, eating candy, it's got to stop. It literally, the stuff splits immune cells in half. I mean, if you're fighting a cold or a bug or something, just eat some sugar and watch how long it takes you to get sick. It'll be pretty fast. Now, that's that. I mean, you know, so a lot of it isn't so much about, I mean, if you eliminate all the junk, then basically everything else that's left is really good for the immune system. So good quality proteins of any kind, fresh fruit, vegetables of any kind, whole grains, all of these things are general immune helpers. And so hope that helps you out a little bit there. It seems like you're already on the right track. Ed, can you explain how sunflower lecithin is a true phosphatidylserine product? I thought sunflower lecithin was in the form of phosphatidylcholine. Please explain how your product is a true PS. Well, you can take a raw material. You're always going to have in any of these oils a certain amount of phosphatidyl grouping. So you have primarily phosphatidylcholine, you'll have phosphatidylserine, and various other ones. But my point here is that when they're being made, they are simply concentrated. So it takes more of the product to actually make the phosphatidylserine concentration. But it is being done, and I switched to the sunflower version specifically because it isn't soy. And, you know, while you can get non-GMO soy phosphatidylserine, I don't like soy in general unless I have to use it for something, so we'll use it here and there when we have to. Some of it isn't going to be a problem, but I just prefer things, if I can find them, when it's possible, that aren't. So that's why we're using the sunflower phosphatidylserine. Diane, how do you recommend we navigate new supplement hype? How can we know which supplements are beneficial, which are overpriced versions of tried and true supplements? I appeal to your wisdom and years of experience to help defend ourselves against the marketers and spend our money wisely. And Diane had mentioned several products, which I'm not bothering to mention because I do not want a flood of questions about different companies' products. But I wanted to answer this question about how to navigate new supplement hype. So I have a few rules that I follow in my own mind. Number one, is it a network marketing company promoting the product? If it is, I throw it in the trash, the wastebasket, and never bother to look at it again, because I know that even if it is a good supplement that this network marketing company may be trying to market, it's five times the price it should be. So that's so they can support the pyramid structure of network marketing. And, you know, I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad marketing method because it seems to work for a lot of people, but it sure adds a lot of cost to products, and they may or may not be any good. And more often than not, they're way more hype than they are reality, and that's a problem of magnitude to the integrity of the industry. And I know there's various network marketers out there maybe listening to me that might take issue with that, but that's how I feel about it based on lots of experience with various network marketing companies over the years. Now, so I just rule out anything a network marketing company is doing, knowing that whatever it is it's doing, I could get much less expensively. And if it were really good, I'd make it too. So then we get into a lot of new things coming out on the market. Everybody's always trying to have a new angle. Some of these are, you know, trademarked or patented combinations of nutrients that have been around a long time, and they've got some study, often an animal study, sometimes a human study, and, you know, they're making claims and so on and so forth, and most of that is just hype. So you kind of have to watch out for that. And sometimes you'll see like a new ingredient come into the marketplace, and so then the question is, well, how much of a guinea pig are you? And who's done the studies on it? So if it's just the network marketing company or some other company that's selling it that's done the studies on it, well, that's a type of data, but it's kind of a low-quality type of data. I like to, the first thing I do if I hear something I might be interested in, I go to PubMed. How do you go to PubMed? You type PubMed in your Google search engine, and the National Library of Medicine, a link to their database homepage will come up. You click on that. You go to PubMed, and then you type in the ingredient or what it is you want to, you know, you type in the ingredient you're trying to find out about, and click Enter, and then you'll get all the studies back on that ingredient that have been actually posted in the scientific literature. And then you might have animal studies, and you can see what they say. Ideally, you'd find some human studies. If it's just animal or cell studies, that's a type of data. I'm not saying it's bad data, but it's just kind of preliminary data. So, you know, if you're considering trying something or you want to fool around with it, you might say, at least understand what kind of data there is about it. In the nutrients that we sell, we try to tell you what that data is. It's difficult because the FDA doesn't like people to know anything. So I have to write articles about the ingredients and not connect them to my products. And that's sort of how I do it. It's not how I would market them if I had my choice, but it's at least how we market in a way that we're still in existence as a company. So most things, even if I think the science is good, I'll wait a while and see what else comes out about them, or I try to understand it. You know, I probably have a little bit better understanding of the chemistry of something than you will trying to read these articles. For most of you, some of you maybe you'll have a better understanding than I will, but my point is the data, you know, don't just rely on what a company's saying. Go to the National Library of Medicine, Google search the database, see what's in there, what kind of studies we got. We got animal studies, we got cell studies, we got human studies. What are these studies saying? What are they supporting? And there you get some idea of whether or not you want to be a guinea pig, or if you want to take something that's been tested out a little bit. All right, Linda says, I'm 70, overweight, in good health, take vitamins, minerals, and herbal supplements. I want to do a 21-day total fast, juice, water, just water and juice. Can I take supplements that suggest a meal? I'm not sure exactly what you mean by can you take supplements that suggest a meal. You can certainly take supplements, and I do not recommend that you do your 21-day fast, water, and juice. The risks to your liver and crashing it are far too great. Your liver runs on protein. When you take the protein out of it, yes, you're kind of giving your body a break, but you're also going to slow down every detoxification enzyme in your body. And you're going to potentially expose yourself to higher levels of chemical sensitivity and worse health following such a fast. So I'm strongly opposed to that. I don't mind if somebody does a day or two or three on water and juice. That's not long enough to induce damage. 7 days is. And you can down-regulate your liver. You know, the way they test, when they want to test mice, when they want it to crash the detoxification system in a mouse, they take all the protein out of their diet. And then they do that. And then they reintroduce protein. And in mice, it takes them 6 months to get their livers working again. 6 months. They don't just come right back on. So you can induce long-term injury to the liver by these kind of diets. And I think they're very reckless. So if you want to do some kind of a fast, I recommend our protein fast, which is water, juice, and protein, and, you know, a meal every now and then. And I've written about that on our website. But I don't recommend these water juice things for extended periods of time. All right, Shelley, last question says, 47 years with no serious health complications, but I'm overweight 40 pounds. Weight didn't become an issue with me until the birth of 3 kids. With each child, I gained more weight. I'm trying to lose the excess weight for a year now, but I've managed to only lose 15 pounds. My biggest problem is I find that after lunch, I'm dragging with no energy into the late afternoon. By dinner, I am like a crazy person when it comes to food, and the positive I did all day is down the tubes. I still eat nutritious, but too much of it. Secondly, if I'm really hungry after hours of not eating at all, I almost always get choked on the first bite or two while swallowing vitamins. I even had to go to the emergency room to get a piece of food removed. Surgically. I've had damage to my esophagus, probably from my large pregnancies where I experienced chronic heartburn. I'm not taking an RX or over-the-counter meds for acid reflux because I know they'll cause more damage. I also believe this problem in my digestive tract is hindering my weight loss efforts, and I would have to agree with you. All right, so Shelley, first things first here. When you have 3 kids, gain weight each one, thyroid is always implicated as a problem. Your body has to do metabolic double time, meaning your thyroid works overtime each time you're pregnant, and if you have inefficiency with weight continuously gaining pregnancy to pregnancy, by definition, your functionality of your thyroid is not up to par. And you've never really gotten yourself back, and now the problems are magnified. Now that you have this problem in your esophagus, You know that the problems are indeed in your digestive tract. If you had heartburn, that's one thing. You can easily, with this reflux and the esophagus that you have now, have a congested gallbladder from the extra weight gain. And so the congested gallbladder is problematic to you, and it is inducing bile to dump into your digestive tract and burning the lining of your digestive tract too easily. And then that creates a permeation of your intestinal lining, which then leaks toxins back into your system and signals your metabolism to go in hibernation mode. So despite all of your best efforts, you are kind of being being depleted by a picture of sluggish thyroid, gallbladder congestion, and intestinal inflammation. So you want to work on these things. So Thyroid Helper can help with the both the gallbladder issue and the bile, as well as helping boost up your metabolism. Other lipotropic nutrients is where you want to focus in terms of getting your liver to move sludge. So that would be things like pantothene, acetyl-L-carnitine. Those would be top choices. And then you want to focus on healing the lining of your digestive tract so it quits poisoning you. The reason you get so hungry is because your digestive tract is signaling not only just hunger for food, but hunger to repair itself. So the hunger signal is called ghrelin in your stomach, and one of the reasons for it is to help heal your digestive tract. So I would use GI and Muscle Helper. I would use the colostrum, say something like Leptislim, which has colostrum in it, or even Super Immune Booster, but Leptislim essentially, and other things to help your digestive tract depending on how you respond. You must get, pine nut oil is great for boosting energy, stopping inflammation in your digestive tract, helping you get through the afternoon. Pine nut oil might just solve your problems, but it also helps repair the digestive tract. So your biggest issue here is that your sort of digestive toxic issues start to flare up in the afternoon and then drag you down. And then you go into whatever, eating too much quote-unquote good food, but it doesn't matter because you're just poisoning yourself with too much food. Pine nut oil, Leptislim, GI and Muscle Helper, GI Soother, target your digestive tract. There's lots of other solutions. Watch my podcasts on the web, or my classes on digestion, Candida albicans, these kind of things. But your digestive tract is indeed burdening your issues, slowing them down, making them more difficult. Fiber is kind of a basic solution. And of course, that's just, the obvious things from your email. There may be other things. And so, Shelley, I would like to invite you and anyone else listening to be sure to join our Leptin Weight Loss Challenge. If you're trying to lose weight and you want to join a bunch of people working on the issue, that's coming up shortly. Check our website and our emails for more information on this. I'll be giving a class on Saturday, in about a week and a half, that will introduce the program. And I'm going to try to help everyone who's interested in losing weight, not only with what the basics are that are relevant, and of course, for me, basics are more than basics. There are lots of helpful information. And then I'll be taking some common questions from all of you in terms of where you're running into trouble. And I'll be helping to explain what to do to overcome these issues. So we'll even, probably have some kind of a checklist of things that you want to understand that could be problems when you're trying to lose weight. So, it's one thing to cut back on calories and eat better and follow the 5 rules of the Leptin diet, and those are all good things to do, but there is a lot more to it than that, and we kind of need to go through an understanding of, well, this is, if you've got this issue, then this is what you do, and these are the most common issues for people that are struggling to lose weight. So how much of that relates to you? You need to understand it and then address that to some extent and then go from there. And there's lots of issues. So by the time you're done with our Leptin Weight Loss Challenge, I certainly would hope that you're much better informed and educated on the subject, and you have a lot more practical strategies under your belt, and you'll have a better way of addressing the issues so that you can solve the more difficult issues that happen. All right. That's it for the podcast this week. If you have any questions you would like to ask me, please email them to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great week, and I'll be back next week with another podcast for you. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.